My name is Justin Walker, and I've been campaigning against what is really happening to the human race. I stagger when I say this, for over 40 years. My background, I served in the military, Territorial Army, commissioned. I was in the family business, tanning, tanneries. I worked in local newspaper. I've done some freelance work for the UN. I've done a multitude of things. But the most important thing is my uncle was a director of the Bank of England for 17 years. He also went to the very first Bilderberg conference in 1954, a year before I was born. And from 1955 to 1972, he was a director of the Bank of England. From that, I moved into social circles with those who clearly control the City of London. My late uncle also had monthly meetings for some time with the Queen, monthly luncheons to talk about the economy. So I got to hear about the behind the scenes, if you like, of what was going on in the City of London. And in 2012, I was given a mysterious phone call from somebody, or his son actually, because he was apparently on his deathbed, who wanted to get the word Bradbury out, which we'll obviously talk about. And that has changed my life from 2012 onwards.
Well,
We go.
you're talking about social circles around the city, around the Bank of England.
Yes,
Can
I
you just give
mean,
us an
well,
idea of what how you think all that stuff operates? Because a
I've
lot of
learned
people are
this.
focusing. We just have the Chancellor's Mansion House speech, and the city does seem to be, many people say, the head of the snake, Justin.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. The first rule, if you're going to defeat your opponent, is the first rule you've got to know who your opponent is, how they operate, where they operate from, and what their weaknesses and strengths are. And it would seem that the City of London is certainly a very, very important part of this hidden layer of control that clearly exists because they're working towards this global technocracy. What you see in communist China is what's going to be coming our way, a digital prison over the next decade. So we can clearly see that there is a mindset, they are organized into groupings. They've got the World Economic Forum, where you get these multi-billionaire technocrats moving alongside owners of big business and so forth, outlining the sort of utopia they want to see. You've also got the Bank for International Settlements, based in Basel in Switzerland as well, which is clearly controlling the world's money. But the City of London and is well, we are told behind the scenes that this is, if you like, the beating heart of the scandal or the well, clearly what is going on. There's no conspiracy theory. It is definite conspiracy against the human race. And of course, there are two other places where we know that they hang out, and that's one of them is Washington, D.C., and the other is the Vatican. But you see, what's interesting is that Professor Richard Werner, who is one of the most celebrated living economists today, stated on a program on Russia Today about 10 years ago now, which amazed the people he was in the studio with. And he just said, look, the City of London is a separate country to the United Kingdom. It is not part of the United Kingdom. And
Yeah, but
this is
hang on, the
why.
Old Bailey, the High Court, there's loads of very
Yeah.
important institutions based there. They've even got their own police force.
The Bank of England is obviously. So essentially, we are all told that the Bank of England is under the control of the Treasury and the government, but it is independent to set interest rates and to do various things to control our money creation and money supply. And yet, it is physically based in a separate country. We've got, as I said, there's a lot going on, Tony, that
Well,
we
look,
are.
this sounds very similar to the Bank for International Settlements, where the Swiss police in Basel are not allowed in there. So the bankers obviously do have set themselves kind of legally in a separate world. But I want to also remind you and listeners that back in the noughties, you were chairing the UK 9/11 Truth campaign. That was a fascinating exercise, really, in trying to uncover what was really behind the 9/11 attacks. Most people now understand that this was a false flag. The buildings were brought down by explosives. Building 7-2. So can you just say what, look at what's going on in Israel now and the genocide, the British establishment support for it, and how it sits with that 9/11 context?
Well, once again, my father was actually involved in what was going on in Israel in 1948. My father was a Royal Marine Commando officer, and he was brought in from Malta with his men, 4-2 Commando, and they were brought in to escort the ending of the British mandate in Jerusalem. They had to escort a 500-vehicle convoy pulling out of Jerusalem to go to Haifa to be taken out at the ending of the British mandate. And some of his men, he sent some of his men out on patrol to check that the road was okay, etc. And they came across a homestead that a father, a mother, and three children had been massacred, gunned down in their home. And some Palestinian women were wrapping the bodies for immediate burial. And it turned out, transpired, that the killers were part of the Zionist paramilitary. They were called Irgun. We had various Haganah, you had all sorts of groups, and the Stern Gang, but this lot were the Irgun. And at the Nakba, where you saw up to 15,000 innocent men, women, and children slaughtered, and over 300,000 moved physically to be able to create the new state of Israel. And it's a bit rich when obviously Israel complains about the atrocity on October the 7th, and it was an atrocity. I don't support any terrorism whatsoever. But I asked the question to all the Zionists and all these groups who accuse you of being anti-Semitic as soon as you step outside the official narrative. And I say, look, you tell me the difference, please. What is the difference between the terrorism used in 1948 and the terrorism that you experienced in 2023? And they can't do that. They can't. The truth is that Israel, Zionism, was established on the use of terrorism. And of course, when you look at the mindset that's happy to kill innocents, and you look at 7/7, and you look at 9/11, all these things, and you notice how the blame is always on the Islam and Muslims, etc. And yet we had the strange case of the dancing Israelis, the five dancing Israelis, I think two of whom were proven to be Mossad agents during the attacks of 9/11. Everywhere you look, you see dirty tricks, and everyone is saying, oh, look, Islam, Islam, it's bad. Islamism is bad. So is Zionism. And I think what is needed now for Israel is a new country to be started, a new country, call it Judeo-Palestine, brackets the Holy Land, call it what you like. The most important thing is take out of it, take out altogether Islamism and Zionism, so you remove the terrorist outlets, which the elite control. And this is the key to everything. When they engineer their problem, reaction, solution, they create the problem, they get the reaction for you. You must do something, you must do
Well,
something.
yeah, this sound that whole thing sounds very much to me like accelerationism. This idea that you're if you create a crisis and the solution to the crisis that you then create is makes things worse. But let me also ask you about the Queen, because she remembers various of her close friends being murdered and executed by the Zionist terrorists in the 1940s, and it's almost as if this has kicked off just after she's died, with now Charles in charge. Her quote, to quote her, and this is quoting the Israelis saying that she said this, that she would not allow any Israelis on any royal property. She said that all Israelis are either terrorists or sons of terrorists. But now
Now,
she's gone.
I didn't know that. And there you've just taught me something I didn't know, Tony, because you come up with these wonderful things. I've known you for some time. And you suddenly come up with stuff which I have to say was under my radar. I didn't know that. And that is a deadly quote. I mean, I know she did tell the Diana's butler, Paul Burrell, there was a darker force pulling the strings. But of course, you've also got to look at the whole royal house of the Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. The Windsors only changed their name to Windsor because there were bombs being dropped on London in 1917 by Gotha bombers. Having seen off the Zeppelins, the Gotha bombers arrived. And obviously, it didn't look too good to to have bombs being dropped on London by planes who carried the name of the British royal family. So some underling in Windsor said, oh, why didn't we call ourselves the House of Windsor? And the king thought it was a jolly good idea.
I don't want to interrupt your story about your father. What was your father's impression of that conflict?
Well, he wasn't out there long. I mean, once he'd gone out there, he escorted trains into Egypt and stuff, and he was on the trains. He actually had a very enjoyable time, even though it was pretty ghastly what was going on. He only fired three shots in anger. One was to put a dog out of its misery, which his driver and jeep had unfortunately run over. And the other time was to let off two shots when they knew they had some Arab marauders trying to pinch things out of the stores. So they just fired over their heads to say, bugger off. So, you know, he wasn't in any danger himself. And the actual Haganah and the other paramilitaries were actual cowards. They wouldn't take on the paras or the marines because they knew they would get back as good as they got, if not a lot more.
Yeah, but the British legacy in the Middle East wasn't totally lost. Of course, we kept and are still using now this Cyprus base at Akrotiri.
Oh, yeah. I think you've got to... I mean, what I say now, after all my research and stuff, when people talk about the British Empire, we're talking about the City of London Empire. I've just had a professor from the Heritage Foundation email, because I link into everybody to observe what they're saying, what they're thinking, and what is the flavour of the month. So I my intelligence gathering is basically linking into all these organisations. He put out an email stating... we must look at the American flag. The American flag is wonderful, and this is how it came about, and this, that, and the other. And I couldn't take that any longer, so I just wrote back a very friendly note. I said, have a look at your American flag. Have a look at those stripes. Now have a look at the flag of the East India Company. And if you look at the flag of the East India Company, it is those exactly the same number of red and white stripes, except in the top left-hand corner, you don't have the stars. You have the Union Jack. And that's no accident, because the East India Company folded. And, of course, the East India Company had an armed force. They had a good army. They had a very powerful naval ship for moving around their merchants and all their supplies and stuff. And essentially, the British military and the British Navy took over. And America, I believe, was corporatized in 1872. It's no accident. And in fact, I've been told, I've never actually been able to prove it, but I've been told by various reliable sources that the City of London actually owns the United States of America, technically. And it's through a company called the Virginia Trading Company. I've still got to check that one out, but it has a ring of truth, because there's no doubt about it, the tentacles from the City of London controlled the world.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, Justin, that you've had this connection through your uncle, Harry Pilkington of the City. The time that he left the Bank of England, he was a director, I think, wasn't he?
He was a director, as I said, from 1955 to 1972.
Well, it's fascinating, because 72 was just about the time that everything started falling apart. So it sounds like your uncle was key to Britain's success. And once he left the Bank of England, everything started going down the drain.
Well, as I said, there's an awful lot. I mean, it was you, Tony, who told me that my uncle went to the very first Bilderberg. That was never mentioned in polite family circles, even though we used to meet people like the late Jacob Rothschild and people like that. Only socially, I don't remember any of the conversations. But I do remember one conversation my uncle had with my father one Christmas at Windle Hall, where he lived. And he said he was the term globalist, you know, my uncle was a lovely man. I'm going to have to put this on record. He was lovely. He was generous. He was eccentric, and everyone loved him. And when he died in December 1983, the entire town of St. Helens virtually turned out on a cold, wintry day to see the cortege go past. And they genuinely loved the man. He loved his roses. He had a fantastic 7-acre garden of roses. He was a lovely man. So I will always say that. And he was an uncle by marriage, and he seemed to take to me. I mean, he gave me two bits of advice at the age of 16, 1972 again, actually. I was on my way back to school to do O-levels, and my uncle was going down to one of his last meetings at the Bank of England.
So whereabouts was this then?
Well, this is on the train going from Liverpool to London. And being a Vancouver uncle, he was saying, we were talking about steam engines. He had an interest in steam engines and railways, which I have as well, and conservation and all sorts. So we got on very well. And he actually, we were discussing things. He suddenly stopped. He said, Justin, what are you going to do for a career? I hadn't really given him much thought. So I said, well, I'll probably go into the family regiment, go into the family business. And he said, well, I'm going to give you two bits of advice to take through life. He said, never, ever believe anything you read in the press because we control it. And never, ever believe a politician when they say they can do something. They can't unless we say they can. Now, it was a bit strange to hear that, but I didn't think too much. I was 16 and I just genuinely thought, well, he's probably talking about banking and City of London. Yeah, I didn't even give it much more thought. I just thought, I didn't need to. It didn't occur to me. It was only in later life as I started to realise that our politicians are not independent and are not there to serve the people who elected them, but they're there to serve shadows. They're there to serve people who are clearly pulling their strings. And of course, I discovered about the City Remembrance.
Well, I mean, let me just chip in, because I can remember in mainstream journalism seeing several politicians completely change their character as soon as the microphone was switched on and stuffed under their nose.
Yeah, they're puppets. And they know what to say if they want to remain. I mean, we often hear that the black books or whatever they are, the party whips have, that they have aspects. I mean, is that famous one that came out in the 1970s or 80s when, was it Fortescue or someone, the chief whip for the Conservatives, said, oh, yes, well, if an MP comes to us and he gave one or two things, and he said, oh, they've been mucking around with boys, you know, children or something, paedophile, we would sort things out. But of course, that meant that we've got one on them and that we can control them. So we've always known that the politician's backgrounds are not particularly good. There are some genuine politicians. I mean, we had one, my mind's just gone complete. The one who was on, who mentioned the bribery in Parliament, Andrew Bridgen. Gosh, my old grey cells are starting to disappear. Andrew Bridgen, bless him, he mentioned the bribery in Parliament and asked why the government was going to bring back the bribery. That to me was proof that he is genuine and he's on our side, because that was the first time the Bradbury pound.
Yeah, they're very few and far between. I was talking to Lib Dem MP and policing minister Norman Baker the other day. He's another one. He's actually a genuine, independent-minded individual, but there's not many. Now, look, you mentioning the Bradbury pound, this, you know, you've mentioned it a few times now, but this has become so interesting to me, in that the whole idea of this, we're seeing some horrific things going on. Let me just be clear about that. The British government's support for the genocide in Gaza is horrific. No ordinary human being could support that, but they are, for some reason. There's also been, over the last couple of weeks, concerted efforts to take literally hundreds of millions of pounds off of our lovely disabled people who desperately need that money for some form of independence, to get around, that sort of thing. In Bristol, we've got them closing off the streets so the disabled people can no longer leave their homes, this kind of thing. And yet we're always told, oh, there's no money for the disabled. We've got to balance the books, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Well, can I just quickly come in, just before we do discuss that, the Bradbury, I just want to mention one story, which again shows the lie that we're all living under at the moment. And that was my uncle arranged with, in fact, I never told you that story about what my uncle said to my father. He said, basically, I'll just sum it up very, very quickly. He said, when a country, when you invest as a company, millions, and of course, millions back in the 1970s is billions today. When you invest millions into a country, you don't want that country nationalizing it. You want to be able to control what the government does in that country to make sure your investment is safe. That's how he justified, I suppose, intrusion in countries' affairs as a globalist. But my mind's just flipped. There's so much stuff in your head these days, all bursting to get out. What was it you just said? You wondered
Well,
about
I asked you about the Bradbury, and I asked you
yes.
about, how we can, do we really have to balance the books? I mean, as far as I can see, the Bank of England can simply print money and it can give it to disabled people, and if it gives it to disabled people or anybody else, they spend it, and that's going to keep the economy going. What we're seeing instead is all sorts of cartels. So if you look down many high streets now, the only shops left are the big chains controlled by the transnational corporations.
Yes, or barber shops set up to muck around with money laundering, and God knows what else going on. No, the whole the when it comes to the economy at the moment, it is about putting people. Oh, that was after I mentioned. Yes, about the climate change. This is very important. My uncle arranged me to go and have a meeting with Aurelio Pecce, who was the co-founder of the Club of Rome. Aurelio Pecce was quite senior in the Fiat Motor Company, and Pilkington Glass provided the glass for Fiat Motor Company, and my uncle knew Aurelio, and
Well, it's a
he
small world, isn't it? Because the Fiat bosses were all big Bilderbergers.
exactly. And so Aurelio attended the second one, I think, on a two more. My uncle attended the first one, but they were friends. Anyway, he wrote to Aurelio, and Aurelio wrote to me saying, "Would you like to come and have lunch?" And this was in May 1982, and at a UN conference being held at, I think it was Olympia. Anyway, I went down there and I had lunch with him and Thor Heyerdahl, the explorer. And unknown to me, he offered me a job because I was in the Ecology Party then, as it was called before it became the Green Party, and I was the party election agent, and unpaid, totally voluntary, and I'd taken an interest in green politics because Jacques Cousteau, the oceanographer, had told people get involved and put ecology and the environment on the map for the politicians. And the best way to do that is to threaten them at the ballot box. So I took up that quite happily. And I was having, as I said, lunch. And at the end of the lunch, he said, "Would you like to come and work at the Club of Rome?" And of course, the Club of Rome are the ones who came up with anthropogenic global warming or man-made global warming. And of course, this is the early days when they were just starting, because up until then, we've been talking about ozone layers and acid rain and various other things. Suddenly, this talk about man-made global warming was starting to appear. But he actually said to me, he said, "Justin, you'll be joining us at a very exciting time. We are creating a huge environmental problem that's going to frighten people into wanting a world government run by us." And of course, at the time, I thought this was brilliant because by us, I thought he meant like my uncle, like Aurelio himself, a lovely man, very chatty, very pleasant. And I thought, well, that's not a bad thing. That's going to be pretty good.
Well, he sounds like quite a charmer.
He was a charmer. Oh, no ifs and buts. They were lovely people. And I was being groomed to become a useful idiot. I was going to become a political researcher. Luckily for me, I'd just been promoted to captain of the Territorial Army. I worked for my father still in business in the tanning trade. I had a new girlfriend. I didn't really want to move to Rome, if I was honest with you. I didn't speak a word of Italian hardly. So I declined, and thank God I did, because I was enjoying myself in the Ecology Party. I thought I was going to become a Green MP very soon. That's how naive we were in those days. And so I didn't. There you are. I had it out of the guy himself, and he wrote something very similar to what he told me. So this entire thing, this whole net zero, everything that's being imposed upon local councils, and the government spending huge amounts of money and wrecking the countryside, all these bloody solar farms and taking away agricultural land, and everywhere we look, we're seeing destruction. And EVs, oh my God, who the hell wants an EV?
Well,
Everywhere
people
you
might want an EV if there's a war in the Middle East. The oil will run out, won't it?
Yeah, but I we've got oil in the North Sea, but no, and we've got plenty of coal. Let's not forget our coal. We've still got massive veins. But I would like to think we would put our energies into looking what Tesla, and I'm not talking about Tesla cars and the name that's being nicked, but Nikola Tesla and others with nuclear fusion as opposed to fission. All these things where scientists believe the breakthroughs are there, but they're being prevented.
So
Well,
it
I would
seems to
imagine.
me we've become hooked on the massive overuse of energy, and
Exactly.
going back to public transport, where you get 100 or 200 or 300 people together and you stick them on a train, send them across the country, you're going to be using a few hundred times less energy to do that. So simple.
Well, I'm where I live now, near Kendal. I walk everywhere now. And we've got a car. We hardly use it, thank goodness. It's not electric, it's petrol, but we hardly use it. We have free bus passes. We use the trains. I've got a direct route to London. To be honest with you, I hardly use the car now, but I'm happy. But the main thing is, I may live in a 15-minute city or town, but I'm here in a voluntary capacity. I enjoy walking. I take the dog, and we can go to shops which are dog friendly. It's all fine. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm doing happily. What I don't want to do or be is enforced to live in a 15-minute city where they've got digital surveillance cameras everywhere trying to punish you, central bank digital currencies, a social credit scheme, all these things that the state is insisting you do. The state knows best, and essentially you don't have the freedom of choice.
Well, what you're hinting at here is what's been actually going on here in Bristol over the last year or so. It's been revealed that the mayor, the former mayor Marvin Rees, who signed a contract to get companies to manage the net zero profile of the city over the next decade, he billions of pounds going to this firm. He himself is being paid by them. Now he's in the House of Lords. So it sounds to me as if, there was a sort of friendly mafia back in the 1950s, which has now been replaced by a rather nasty bunch.
Exactly. I think that's a very good way of summing it up, because it's never been perfect since the City of London. In fact, I'm going to be honest with you, because I'm working with a guy called William Keate and various others, and we've all identified the Glorious Revolution was not glorious for the people. It was glorious for the bankers. The Glorious
So this is
Revolution.
William of Orange,
William of Orange,
in the 1680s, yeah.
1688. And then you had the Bill of Rights, and you had all this stuff. You had the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Rights in 1689. When you look at it, of course, what you saw from that, William of Orange signed the Royal Charter to create the Bank of England in 1694. And with that, you got the national debt. But of course, the most important thing that people don't realize is that who came across, when people say, oh, the last time Britain was invaded was by the Normans in 1066. No, it was 1688. It was mainly done by Dutch forces. The very fact that a lot of British or English forces were happy to work with them, because William of Orange was clearly, he was married to James II's daughter and all the rest of it, Mary. But what came across with William were the bankers of Amsterdam, who were formerly the bankers of Venice, the Venetians, who are really called the Black Nobility. And he goes back 4,000 years to Samaria and to going back in history. But this mindset of controlling the money came across with William and Mary. And after that, the City of London, which was already an independent city, because it was mentioned in the Great Charter, Magna Carta, 1215, etc., it had privileges. It was granted privileges by William I in 1066, or was it 1067? And before that, it was a Roman settlement where the traders did well. So it's always been powerful. And we
Well,
can also.
it's what you're saying is sort of sparking off in me some rather. So we're talking here about William and Charles. We've now got Charles and William. If you go back to the 17th century, you've got Charles's, the two Charles's. You've got another William. You've also got the Conqueror William. So maybe this new William is going to be some kind of transformative chap. These people, I think, do think like this. But look, let's get back to the Bradbury Pound, because we've
Well,
completely
can we just.
we're in a situation now where we've got complete like financial slavery, basically. So everybody is beholden to money all the time. Most of the time, the money is there. Supposedly, it's supposed to be there to serve humanity. It's now being used to enslave us. But you got this phone call about the Bradbury Pound, didn't you?
Yeah, this is quite a funny story, actually. But it was I call it my Richard Hannay moment, like in the 39 steps, you know, I'm minding my own business, doing nothing. And then suddenly I get given a phone call, which changes my entire look of things virtually. Anyway, what it was, back in September 2012, my wife was in the kitchen. My daughter was in the lounge doing her homework. And I was just milling around, trying to be, well, not doing much really. And the phone goes. And so I answer it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's going to be one of my wife's friends, which means I'll have to go in the kitchen to keep an eye on the cooking, etc. But anyway, this very posh boy says, oh, hello, is that Justin Walker? So I jokingly say, well, it might be. Oh, well, let me put your mind at rest. Is that Justin, the nephew of Sir Harry Pilkington, later the Lord Pilkington of St. Helens? I said, yes. He said, well, you don't know me, and I'm afraid I'm not going to give you my name, and the number is going to be withheld. But I'm ringing on behalf of my father, who is not long for this world. And he was a director at the Bank of England with your uncle. So I went, oh, right, okay. And then he said, I've just read your article in the latest UK column. In those days, UK column was a newspaper. Now, I had actually written an article because I'd come across a lady in America. Gosh, my mind's just gone blank again.
Is it Ellen Brown?
Thank you very much for helping me there. You know, the old grey cells, I'm nearly 70 and things, you know, you haven't got dementia yet. Anyway, going back to Ellen Brown, she'd written about how during the American Civil War, advisors to Lincoln, when he was told that the money was running out and the first Battle of Bull Run had been lost, and basically Washington looked as though it was going to be taken by the Confederates, and things were looking pretty bleak. And he looked to borrow money from the City of London, the Rothschilds and the various, and they were offered anything from 24 to 36% interest. And he realised that was going to cripple and put the North's economy into a debt noose. So one of his advisors said, well, why don't you just create paper money that's based on the, well, actually, they said the integrity of the nation, which if you, or no, based on the integrity of the government, that's what he said originally, which I laugh because if you talk about the integrity of our government, you wouldn't get much value. But anyway, the point was, they said, look, we had colonial scrip in the 1740s, 50s, 60s, something like that. And that was probably the real reason for the American Civil War, because some of the colonies were creating paper money that was based on the wealth of the actual colony. And that money was used to exchange for goods and services, and it was money that people had complete confidence in, and it was great. And they pulled away from borrowing gold or anything from the City of London. The City of London hated it, and they people, some historians say that's the real reason for the American War of Independence. But going back to Lincoln, he went back, he suddenly started creating this debt-free, interest-free paper money based on the integrity, but really the better way to describe it is on the value of the North and what the economy was worth. And this money was created. The manufacturers for the weapons and the weaponry needed to fight the war were happy to accept it. The troops fighting the war were happy to accept it. Everyone was happy to accept it. And it was called greenbacks because on one side it was green ink used to create money. On the other side it was grey. And it worked. And, of course, many historians believe this is the real reason why Lincoln ended his life with an assassin's bullet because essentially the City of London didn't want his kind anywhere near. And it's interesting to note that one of the supporters of the North and Abraham Lincoln were the Russians, and the Russians are, and they were totally opposed to the Rothschilds and everything that was going on. It's fascinating when you see how things developed.
Yeah, but what about the British version, the Bradbury Pound?
Yeah, they're going back to Bradbury Pound. So in other words, I'd written this article saying we should have a greenback pound. And I didn't think much more of it. I just thought it was an interesting way of, you know, asking to see if we'd get a debate going. Anyway, going back to this conversation, the chap said, well, my father has read your article in the UK column, and he wants you to know the word Bradbury. Now, he didn't say Bradbury Pound. He just said Bradbury. And, of course, this is when it becomes quite funny because I realised my laptop was closed. There was no paper, no pen by the phone. And so I breathed on the window and scribbled Bradbury. so I wouldn't forget. And he went on and said, look, I'm not going to talk much longer. My father says, if you research the Bradbury, you will find the solution to all of Britain's economic woes. Now, it's been very nice talking to you. Please do this, et cetera, et cetera. Nice talking to you. Goodbye. And of course, as soon as he went off the phone, I did 1471 to see if the number, and it was a number withheld.
And it had been withheld. But anyway, we've only got a couple of minutes, Justin. Can you?
Well, right.
Explain?
Well, I'll just go through it quickly. I fed in the Bradbury and found out that essentially it wasn't Bradbury, the lady who walks railway lines and stuff. It wasn't Bradbury who wrote the Martian Chronicles. But I came across a book called The Financiers and the Nation, written by an MP in the 1930s, who was an honourable MP, Thomas Johnston. And he described the whole story of how when Britain declared war against Germany and they were on the gold standard, because they'd issued out more paper money from the Bank of England than they had with the gold in the vaults to back it, essentially, there was going to be a run of the banks because people wanted to get their hands on gold and not paper money because of the uncertainty of a global war breaking out. So the government created overnight, passed a bill through Parliament, getting organised and printed Bradbury notes, because they were signed by Sir John Bradbury, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury. And this money was based on the wealth and the credit of the British nation.
Okay, so what year was this?
1914. This is August the 7th, 1914, it came out. But only last week I was told by a researcher who has written a huge tome, he only produced 100 books, called Operation Zion, that in fact the evidence is there that these notes were printed 1 week before the outbreak of the First World War, because the war was triggered by the Zionists, the bankers, the Rothschilds.
Well, it was triggered by an assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, surely.
Yeah, and who ordered that? I mean, again, there's so much history, real history, that yet to come out. But the bottom line is, you will find the people who create and control the world's money unlawfully are behind it. The Bradbury pound is the same type of money that is actually the change, the loose change in your pockets. The loose change in your pockets created by the Treasury. And it's debt-free, interest-free money. It never has any slogan like, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of. This money is produced by the Treasury, courtesy of the Royal Mint, and it is debt-free, interest-free, because it's based on the wealth of the nation.
Well, it sounds to me as if Rachel Reeves needs to know something about this, because she keeps saying there's no money for this, that. There's money for Ukraine. There's apparently money for the Israelis, but there's no money for disabled people. Yeah.
The shortage of money is being used to control us. Now, if your listeners could go to thegreatrising.org/money, and it's WWF, the-great-rising.org, and then put money in, you will see the whole story of how we are trying to get the Chancellor. She will not answer six basic questions, and people can see the pathetic responses we've had.
Well, I suppose if thousands of people contact her, and actually, I mean, these Bradbury pounds, do any still exist?
Oh, yeah, well, I've got one in my pocket. Mine was created about late 1914. You can still buy them today. But the important thing is this. The government then went back. Having saved the banks from collapse, they started to phase the Bradbury out and going back to selling bonds to the City of London. So the bankers were buying up bonds at 3.5% interest. But it meant the national debt went up from £650 million in 1914 to, in 1919, at the Treaty of Versailles, it went up to 7,500 million. And bear in mind, a pound in those days is equivalent to about 140, 150 pounds today because of inflation. Everything is all about control of people by being able to unlawfully control how much or how little money the world is allowed
to
spend.
Well, I mean, this sounds like, to me, like the classic debt trap. It's almost like the same sort of situation where you've got an aristocrat and he's got his farmers and he makes sure that they have to get lots of money to pay him and they haven't got the money. So he's extracting from them all the time. A classic debt trap.
Yeah, total debt. It's a debt noose. But to sum up everything, The time has, I mean, we always joke the peasants are revolting. My wife says I'm revolting every day. You know, the usual joke, the peasants are revolting. The peasants' revolt of 1381, everything. By the way, it was the mayor of the City of London that stabbed Wat Tyler. So let's not forget that the City of London even played a part then. But let's get back to the 16th century, because I know you are a fan of the diggers. I'm a fan of the levellers. We really want to create a new movement in this country. We started a strategy called Humanity First, which you can read when you go to thegreatrising.org website. But we're now starting to get people to think about a winning strategy, because everything that's been set up to control us is a house of cards. And if we took back control of money creation and money supply and made the whole thing transparent, accountable, and we created a society which fully controls how our money is created as debt-free, interest-free money. The globalists, all those people we've talked about, the black nobility, all of them, they wouldn't be able to control us.
Well, you do look at the Mansion House speech, you look around the room, and it does look as if many of those people, Justin, are just there for the status that comes with it. They've got no real ability to run or manage anything. So I think we ought to also mention there are some good ways into this if people are fresh to it. For example, Bill Steele's films, The Secret of Oz, and The Money Masters, which came out before that. Yeah. Have you got any other recommendations of starting points?
Well, I mean, obviously, everything I've been doing is on a personal one-to-one with the Chancellor. And my MP, Tim Farron, has been sending the letters, so it's not just getting lost in the post or getting lost in the ether with emails. He is physically...
Well, they know about this, surely. They just don't want to know.
They don't. They don't want to respond. So this is the fourth letter going in. I'm writing it as of today. Now I've seen the Mansion House speech.
I mean, surely the time for letters is over. What needs to happen is some form of action, direct action of some sort.
Well, once we've got... Yeah, I would totally concur with that. As long as it's peaceful, I totally concur with that. But the most important thing is we've got to get this fourth letter out through an MP, so it's gone formally. And if they can't respond, then that blows apart the entire financial and banking system. And the hub of it, yes, the Bank for International Settlements, a lot going on in Switzerland is a part of it, but the beating heart of the black nobility, the elite, the globalists, the New World Order, whatever you want to call them, the beating heart is the City of London.
Well, so Rachel Reeves has given her speech last night to the Mansion House, the Chancellor, and of course, very obsequious the whole thing is. There are some, apparently, some news stories around that the entire financial system, although we do hear this quite regularly, may be on its knees and maybe a bit on a wobble, Justin.
It'll be controlled if it does, because what they have to bring in is a central bank digital currency, which then would be attached to a social credit system, which means that every single transaction, whether it's a bar of chocolate, right through to buying a car, would be controlled and decided upon by artificial intelligence. And that's what's happening in China, in the big cities of China, not in the rural areas, but in the big cities of China, these smart cities. This is what's happening. A friend of mine who was a businessman was in a sweet shop getting, he was buying something for a snack or something, and a Chinese gentleman in front, and he was rather, shall we say, fat. Okay, are we allowed to say that? Yeah, he's fat, full stop. And he tried to buy something which obviously wasn't going to be very good for him, and paying with his card, digital, and it wouldn't accept it because his medical records were part of the means of buying. They knew he
And you
was
think this could be coming to Europe?
Oh, this is definitely coming. Good grief. You look at everywhere you look, it's all data collection. And they will marry your health records. Everything is coming. They're going to have digital ID. You know, everything is coming, Tony, like a fast express train. And you've only got to look at China, the model. I mean, it was no accident that the guy who controls the WEF, his son was out there in China helping the Chinese government come up with this technocracy. So Klaus Schwab's own son was out there in China for a few years, and he was overseeing this CBDC.
Well, look, I mean, if we go back to the early 1900s in the 20th century, if you look at the Yale in China group, they were out there financing Chairman Mao to start the revolution. In fact, giving him money for bookshops and things like this. So this is the skull and bones society.
Yeah, everything. I mean, the We know what's going on, Tony, because we've been lucky enough to have open minds to literally. But people waking up since COVID, it may come as a bit of a shock. But you've just got to have an open mind and accept that the history you were taught in schools, forget it. You've now got to really look into the detail. I mean, there are some fascinating books I've just been reading.
One of my producers at the BBC, she was a lovely woman, actually, but I remember her saying to me, we haven't told them what to think yet.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, you don't know.
That pretty well sums the whole thing up, doesn't
you
it?
You don't know what you don't know.
No, exactly.
Anyway, finally, can you just give listeners an idea of, if they're interested in picking up on this, doing something about it, how do we sort this out?
Well, what we're coming up with this strategy, have a look at thegreatrising.org. Have a look at the Humanity First, a Freedom Strategy. It's developing. We're still in the process of doing it. It's work in progress. We've got some people like Matt Letizia and other people like that on board. I mean, it is going. What we're trying to do is empower people at a local level to win over the local councils, to get rid of all this net zero rubbish, and to show them how money is created and money supply. That when they say they've got no money and everything else, this is a lie coming from central government. In other words, we win over people in a friendly way at a local level, because all these people have businesses, all these people have families, all these people are suffering at the same way. It's only a tiny number who are getting overpaid.
Well, that's right, but look, this is all online stuff. Do you ever meet face to face?
We do. I mean, I can't myself. I'm being a pensioner. I can't go travelling around the country. I tend to do all my things by Zoom and talking to people and coming up with the stuff. But we just encourage local people to come together under this new banner of Humanity First, because we don't want left. We don't want right. We want to break away from the political spectrum. The left-right political spectrum is dead, because that is the way they control you. Oh, they control the left, they control the right, and then the left says they're going to reorganize, the right says that is all about control. We want people to recognize that we're all human beings and human values must come to the fore.
Well, I totally agree. And the basic rights, like a roof over your head. I mean, it seems to me we've got a horrible situation where people can't pay their mortgages. Many people, they can't pay their rent. We've got 800 or so people living in caravans and vans here in Bristol now. So what about the land issue?
Can I just quickly say the very important point here, Tony, is that everything that's been done in Parliament, everything that's been done at the World Economic Forum, UN, all these organisations, everything that's been done is being done with mens rea, malice aforethought. And we are a common law country. And if there's a mindset setting out to entrap us, to deceive us, and to put us into effectively a technocracy, a dictatorship using the digital world, then we can annul this under common law, because everything is being done deliberately to imprison us. And we can walk away and annul all this legislation and start again. And that includes creation of money. And all debts can be annulled. The national debt will be annulled, because that was set up in 1694 with mens rea as a deliberate way of entrapping a nation into compliance with what the bankers wanted. Everywhere you look, we can annul this stuff. We must not be frightened of legislation. Not frightened at all. The common law, the belief, you know, the ordinary people can meet to decide yes or no about guilt or not guilty, but most importantly, to judge the legislation to see if it's fair and just. And if it's not fair and just, they annul it. They can start.
Well, it's a bit difficult to do that if you've been locked up.
Well, we won't be locked up. Our numbers are too great. And remember, the police and the army, they will side with the people. They're not going to side with them. They're going to side with the people. And I think this is what we've got to remember. We are literally a new movement, the diggers of the levelers. You know, we are a new peaceful movement who are not going to take this crap any longer. And we're going to walk away from it peacefully and just say, what are you going to do about it? We've got the numbers.
OK, so if people are interested in the Great Rising, the Bradbury Pound, can you just remind us whereabouts that is?
It's at the www.the-great-rising.org. And that will take you. And there's all sorts of links and various articles written and stuff. What we're trying to do is, look, you know, we don't want leadership. We want a linear movement. We don't need leaders. We don't need people like Nigel Farage and all these people who are all controlled. I mean, Farage is controlled. I can tell you that now. He'll go where the money goes. No,
Well,
everywhere
he's in with the Israelis.
Of course he is. I mean, everywhere you look, we want a linear movement where decent people with common values, human values, come together and we work together. But we don't need leaders. I have no intention of being a leader. I don't want to be a politician in London. I will tell you now, my ambition, I'm 70. I don't know how many years I've got left, but I've got a model railway to build. I've got little things, hobbies I like, I enjoy. I don't want to be doing this, but I have to do it until we win. And I'm just one out of thousands of people now who have woken up, tens of thousands, possibly millions. And we've just got to work together in peace and harmony, using the common human values and using the common law, and we will win. We can't
but
lose.
Yeah, but what happens when the economy collapses like it did in 1929 and the bad guys have got their own little...
Yeah, but the thing is, we have got the ability now to communicate en masse. All right, they may drop the internet may crash and all the rest of it, but there's enough of us who can then organise a local community and say, look, we know what's going on, we know what the solutions are, and there's nothing to stop a local community starting their own creation of money. This is what the little island of Guernsey did after the Napoleonic War. I mean, even Liverpool did it. So you can do it, and it's not a case of creating token money which is based on the pound sterling. You can create new money because it's based on the wealth and the labour potential, the creativity of your local community. And remember what money is. Money is simply a convenient unit of exchange for goods and services that people have complete confidence in. They used to use seashells and salt. We used to have those pieces of wood. What do they call them? You know, I mean, it's just a case of human beings coming together who are there for the good of all, and not for the selfish belief that they can make money at somebody else's expense. When good people come together with common sense and human values, we can win. And that is what's going to happen. There's no ifs and buts about it. The other side are on the back foot. I know that from my inside friends. They are well behind on their rolling out of their net zero and stuff. They are worried because too many of us have woken up. So we mustn't be frightened by any false flags or anything like that. Stick to the central path. And the essential part of it all is those who control the money control the world. Well, there's nothing to stop us controlling that money. As long as we have the knowledge, and it is knowledge. It's all about having knowledge. At the moment, it is our collective ignorance that is their protective shield. Once we have the knowledge, they're lost.
Well, that's, I suppose, why the BBC is so important. It's to stop that knowledge getting out. Anyway, Justin Walker, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.